The thing I first want to ask you about that I found the most fascinating is sort of the intersection between your home, your teaching style, and your neighbors. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit, first of all, about your home.
I came to Ann Arbor in 64, and I went on my first sabbatical and came back to my old apartment on Oakland. And one afternoon, a car stopped me on the street, and this lady leaned over. It was Margaret Malcolmson, and her husband was the dean of the architecture school of the old A&D. And Margaret said, "My house is for sale. You should buy it." And she drove off. So I called her the next day and told her I'd been thinking about it, and gee, that would be interesting. And she told me I could come see it. And she said, "But you have to come see it when Reg isn't here," because Reg was a very opinionated man who didn't believe in color, among other things. He was an architect. And their house was all either gray or white or black. Reg always was dressed in black with a white shirt and a gray tie. And Reg didn't believe in color. The kitchen was Margaret's, and it was bright Kelly green. But everything else was gray or white or black. The Malcolmsons had lived there for years. Their kids had grown up there. And eventually, Reds decided they should buy the house. And the woman who owned it lived in Pennsylvania. So Reg got in touch with her, and she said yes, she'd be willing to sell it. And she told him the price. And he said, "Fine, but we'll count all these years of rent as payments toward my buying the house." And she explained, no, that wasn't how it worked. And so he got angry and hung up. And then she decided she really did want to sell it, but Reg wouldn't cooperate with people seeing the house. So eventually Margaret called me one day in the office here at the university and said, "Come up now, he's gone." So I went up and quickly looked through the house and such, and I made an offer for the house, and the woman sold it to me. So I moved in, and I knocked out a wall and here and there and did various things to it and finally got myself settled in by the 1st of September.
And then did you start having students over right away?
Well, yeah. First I inherited three kids from friends of mine, one at a time, in New Jersey, who stayed there. And then that was so comfortable, I started having usually two kids who'd live on the third floor, and I would trade them room and board for washing dishes and cleaning house. And I always had students from classes over one night a week just to talk about whatever it was we were studying. And I'd done that in my apartment, and now I had this house with a big living room, so there were three nights a week for students coming over. I guess it was somewhere along in there that I decided to give the house a name. I guess I always need plenty of things to do. So deciding I was giving the house a name was fun. In my favorite novel, I'm a Dickens scholar, sort of. My favorite novel is David Copperfield, and David Copperfield grows up in a house named Blunderstone Rookery. So I bought wooden letters about 4 inches high, and put them up over the door, Blunderstone Rookery. And people going down the street, at first that I did it one summer, that students coming down from Oxford Housing would stop and look at it and wander on. And eventually people sort of got accustomed to its being Blunderstone Rookery and would refer to it as such. One weekend I called, this is before email, 16 senior colleagues all over the university, the dean of the law school, several professors of medicine, chairman of the chemistry department, another chemist, a physicist, George Peranian in math, from Diane Kirkpatrick in history of art, people from all over the university, and they came over on Sunday afternoon, and I explained to them that we were going to found the Society of Bremen Scholars. Do you know the Musicians of Bremen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I wanted to do it in protest against the university, which was getting so impersonal. And I told them that we were going to meet on Monday nights from 7:30 till 12, and that everybody had to come every week, and we would sign in. And everybody had to invite two students to become members, and the students had to know that they were members for at least 1 year, and they had to come every week.
How long did it last?
Oh, it lasted for 10 years.
That's pretty good.
And finally it ended because I loved it, but I decided I've been taking every Monday night of the school year from all these friends for 10 years, and that probably isn't fair. So I told them I would like to disband. And they all agreed that, well, maybe it was time. But it was wonderful. They'd get there at 7:30, and we'd all stir around eating cheese and drinking good wine or cider or beer. I had a beer tap in the kitchen sink. And then at 8:30, I would ring a bell, and we would all have to squeeze into the living room, sitting on the floor, standing behind couches, anywhere. But we'd all get in there, and two people who would have volunteered the week before had to present some kind of program for a half an hour, an argument about something. And then we would all sit there and squabble about it for an hour. And then at 10 o'clock, we'd go back to drinking beer and cider and wine and eating good cheese until midnight. And whoever was last one out of the house had to help me clean up. And I'd go to my 9 o'clock lecture on Tuesday morning. One night, the dean of the law school said something that wasn't a very good answer in response to something. And this one student said, "Excuse me, Ted, but that's really stupid." And the dean turned and said, "Sorry." And we went on. Yeah, it was a wonderful kind of experience for all of us, that we got to argue about serious things, and nobody had rank or anything else.
You also had, I understand you had several, you've had a prime minister stay with you, you've had poets. Can you tell me a few?
When Edward Heath was prime minister, I was living in London. This is in the 60s. Mr. Heath was a Tory, and the Tories were trying to keep the miners' union in control. And there was a coal strike, and Heath responded by curbing electricity usage in London and put us on a rota so that every other 3 hours you had electricity. All sorts of things like this. And there were lots of demonstrations, and the BBC one night had a call-in program about the miners' strike, and people were saying things in different directions. And I called in and said I couldn't understand why Londoners weren't burning down the Houses of Parliament in response to the Heath government. And the next day, the Guardian had a report, the Manchester Guardian, the Guardian now, had a front-page report on this BBC show talking about, you know, the different kinds of things people said, and the article ended saying, and there was one American who called in wanting to know why we didn't burn down the Houses of Parliament, when Heath had long since given way to Margaret Thatcher, whom he despised. He was a big opponent of Thatcher in the Commons. He was still there as a member of the House of Commons. And he's a very articulate and bright man. He'd come into government after World War II, when Churchill was prime minister, and Heath made his maiden speech in Parliament, arguing for a European Union. Churchill had first broached the idea of a European Union in 1939, and then with the war, it got scotched. Churchill was so impressed by this young man who had stood up and made his maiden speech that he made him a junior member of his cabinet. And eventually Heath was prime minister. When Mrs. Thatcher became prime minister, he was furious. They didn't speak to each other. And I was working in the honors office here, and I wrote Mr. Heath a letter and told him that when he was prime minister, I had been an awkwardly vocal opponent of his, but that now I was a great admirer of his, and I invited him to come to the university for 2 weeks and conduct a seminar on the future of the European Union. I didn't expect an answer, but about a week later, I got a phone call, and this young man's voice said, Mr. Heath had my letter and was very interested and said, how much are you going to pay him for these 2 weeks? And I hadn't even thought about that. So I said, well, I think we could pay him 10,000 pounds. And he paused and he said, that's not an appropriate amount to pay the former prime minister. But I don't think it matters because he really wants to come. He did. I got 16 good students, juniors and seniors, from different departments in the honors program to sign up for this seminar. And until he got there in the spring, starting in January, I had a seminar for them on Heath's career in politics, Britain's relationship with the continent, trying to fill them in so they'd have some sort of background for dealing with what he wanted to talk about. I was to pick him up at the airport, and I was just going to go out in my little yellow Volkswagen to pick him up, and the powers that be said,
no.
They would send a vice president with me. In a university car. So we arranged for the vice president to come to my house, and the car was to come pick us up there. And we waited and waited and waited, and I kept looking at my watch and saying, you know, we really... And finally I said, well, you can wait for the car if you want. I'm going to go pick him up. So I went out to get in my car, and he came trotting along after and got in, and we went out to the airport. And Mr. Heath got off the plane, and I introduced myself, and we shook hands, and I introduced him to the vice president, and he looked at the vice president and said, "Au revoir." And we got in the car, and he was in the front seat with me, and we were just sort of chatting a bit, and the vice president was sitting in the back seat, leaning forward, and we're riding along, and this was during the days of the riots in London, sort of riots over Margaret Thatcher's poll tax. And Heath was being a very vocal opponent of the poll tax. We're riding along, and there's a car on the side of the road. And Mr. Heath said, what's that? And I said, it's a car that's broken down, Mr. Heath. And he said, probably caused by the poll tax. And we laughed, and we went on a little bit farther. And there was another car broken down. And he made another comment about people running the U.S. must be pretty bad if... And our vice president said, I don't understand, Mr. Heath. Bert says you're a conservative. And he looked at me and said, your vice president doesn't understand the word conservative, does he? And I said, no, sir, he doesn't. So the vice president leaned back and we went on. Nobody across the street then had any idea who he was or what it meant to have been a conservative prime minister. And when they got him, they were shocked. And everybody thought he had been a Labour prime minister. And I kept having to correct them. But the things he said seemed to the people I'm talking about to be leftist. So therefore, he had to be a Labourite. His seminar was wonderful. We met in Inglis House. After the seminar met from 10 till 1, 4 days a week for the 2 weeks. And after the seminar, he and I would have lunch catered there in Inglis House. And after the first day or so, he said, where did my students go? And I said, oh, they went off to lunch, Mr. Heath. He said, why aren't they having lunch with us? I could go out and teaching them.
Oh, that's great.
So I made a phone call and explained that they had to cater lunch for Mr. Heath's students, too, because he wanted them. So after that, they had this nice lunch at Engle's house, and he would just continue class until, almost 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then he would be tired. He was in his late 70s then. Then he'd be tired and go take a nap for a couple of hours. He was just wonderful. And told me, in the evenings, I should invite students over so we could talk. And so I'd invite students over, and we'd just sit and have dinner and talk and drink wine. And we became friends. And after that, as we were going to the airport, when I was taking him out, he said, I used to take 13 kids every summer on a 10-week summer trip in England and Ireland. And as we're riding to the airport, Mr. Heath said, when do you bring your students to England? And I told him, and he said, good. On the Saturday, you can bring them to my home. He had a lovely house in Salisbury facing the cathedral. So that summer when we got there, the day we left Oxford, we drove down to Salisbury in our big van. And we went in, and he showed us around the house and all the things he had. And then we'd sit down in the garden and have tea and something to nibble on. And they all had to ask him questions, and he would answer them. He was so kind. If somebody asked him a question that wasn't really much of a question, he would manage to sort of manipulate it a little bit until he turned it into a good question, and then he would answer. And we'd stay there for 2 or 3 hours. It was really fun.
So you took your students, you had students at your house, you took them on trips. You are obviously engaged in more unconventional ways of teaching. And I read that you felt there was an importance in the ambience of the learning community. And it sounds like this is what you're telling me, bringing them here, taking them there, house, the home.
Yeah, class periods aren't very long. I was lucky when I was an undergraduate, I had two English professors at Notre Dame who let me be a friend. One of them was my freshman English teacher. It was a sophomore level honors class. And the other kids in it were terribly bright and they had read things. And I hadn't read anything at all coming from Bowling Green, Kentucky. And I was sort of intimidated for a while, but eventually I sort of got comfortable with the Greeks and we were going along pretty well. And one Sunday afternoon, I called my professor at home. We didn't have phones in our rooms, but there was a phone on each floor in the dormitory. So I called him at home and told him who it was and that I would like to come see him just to talk. And he said, fine, why don't you come over? And I said, okay, but you'll have to come pick me up because we don't have cars. So he picked me up, and I went over, and he and his wife and I sat and had a wonderful afternoon, and she fed me dinner. And then eventually she drove me back to the dorm. When I started graduate school, I guess I sort of used him and the other teacher whom I knew very well, sort of as models. And so I started having my freshman students over occasionally to talk. And when I came to Ann Arbor, it took me 2 years before I had enough students that I could sort of cause them to want to gather in their spare time just to talk about things. And that's when I was running the poetry series that ran for 10 years. And the English department used to have one poetry reading a year. Mm-hmm. There'd be a faculty member who was in charge of the lecture series, and the new chairman asked me to become the chairman of that, and I said I would, but that I was going to spend the $300 on a poet. And he said that was okay, he didn't care. And then I discovered, well, I couldn't get any poets any good for $300, so I went to see the dean. And he told me, no, he didn't have any money for things like that. And then I went to see the vice president for academic affairs, and no, he didn't have any money for such. So then I went to see the president, Robin Fleming. And I told Mr. Fleming what I wanted. And he said, "Oh, Bert, it'd be easy if you wanted more, but it's going to be, if you wanted $10,000, I wouldn't have any trouble getting that, but it's going to be hard to get $1,000. And he thought for a minute and said, "Tell you what you do." He said, "You go back to see the vice president, and you tell him that I'm going to give you $1,000 if he will give you $1,000. I said, "Okay." And he said, "And then you go see the dean, and you tell him." And he said, "And then you'll have $3,000. And since you said you only need two, I won't give you mine." So we started out with $2,000. And I built it then, and by saving money, by getting really good people to come here, so that we could have 20 readings a year, plus an undergraduate reading in the fall and a graduate student reading in the spring. And because all the good people came, not because of me and my poetry series so much as because Donald Hall was here, yeah. And Don lived next door. And there were always poets coming through visiting Don anyway, so now I could get them to give readings while they were in town. And then because those people were all reading here, all sorts of other people wanted to read here. And so I would get, as many as 200 letters every summer from poets wanting to come read in Ann Arbor.
I have a great quote here from Donald Hall, actually said, I read this. On a January day in the 80s, you borrowed the university's Rackham Auditorium, sold tickets for a joint poetry reading, invited some friends, Wendell Berry, Seamus Heaney, and on a Friday night against a basketball home game and the Chicago Symphony, you filled 1,100 seats with poetry, with paying poetry fans. The fire department permitted 100 standing room only tickets, and busloads of people came from Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee, and Michigan's UP.
Yeah.
This was in the 80s.
Yeah, this was this 85 was or 87. I ran the poetry series for 10 years, and at the end of it, I was just worn out because poets would arrive for the Tuesday readings on Monday and leave on Wednesday usually. But the good folks and the ones I knew would arrive on Sunday, and they might not leave until the next Sunday. Eventually, Don and I set up together a thing called Poetry Ann Arbor, which got some money from the state Arts Council to send poets into high schools and junior highs, and so I could pay people an extra $100 if they wanted to do those things. And it was just so much fun having this wonderful sort of poetry thing happening, constantly in Ann Arbor. But after 10 years, I was just worn out, so I quit. And then I missed it. And so, Robert Bly would, after it was over, Bly would insist still on coming every year because he was in the habit of it. And every now and then, Galway Connell would call from New York and say, would you mind if I came out and did a reading? And so he'd come out. So we had a few of them still. And then I decided I would like to just have a big reading with friends. And it would give them a chance to be together. So I got 10 students to help me organize this, and I got Rackham, Don and Jane, and Wendell Berry and his wife, Tanya, from Kentucky, and Galway Connell, and Seamus Heaney. Murray didn't come, but they arrived on Friday. And we had a wonderful time Friday afternoon, went out to dinner, talked until God knows when, and got up Saturday morning. Spent most of the day just sitting around talking. I went over early for the reading. Got there, and the place was already full, and there were all sorts of people outside, and the fire marshal was busy standing there saying, no, no, no. And finally, we made the deal for 100 more students, or 100 more people to get in. And there were still lots of people there. And he came up to me and said, "I'm going home." And I thought about it for a while, and I didn't know if that meant, "Don't you dare let anybody else in," or simply, "I'm not responsible if you do." So I told the kids who were doing tickets that they could let anybody in who had driven, who had come from more than 250 miles away. So they let in another maybe 200 people. The aisles were full, everything. And they read for half an hour each and then took a break. Went out and signed books during the break for 20 minutes. And then came back and were supposed to read for 10 more minutes each. But then they also sort of expanded that because they were really having a good time and the audience was loving it. And finally they quit. And the four of them stood there and Galway Connell kept saying, "Feels like being a rock star." And they were standing there on the stage, bowing and bowing and bowing, and everybody was applauding. And it was sort of comical that everybody just kept applauding. And they were all standing there laughing and waving. And finally, Galway insisted I get up on the stage with them. So he and Wendell yanked me up onto the stage, and the five of us stood there for a bit. And finally, Seamus said, "I think we should get out of here." So I said, "Okay, we'll just start backing up." And we backed up, and we got back to those strange-looking columns on the, which have doors in them. Mm-hmm. So I got us back to there, and I was on the end then. And I went over and opened the door, and we all ran out the door and went down to the garage, and I'd parked a car that I'd borrowed in the basement for us so we could drive home.
So were you surprised? Were they surprised that there was that much interest and that much attention?
Yeah. I expected the house to be full, but I didn't expect that.
How do you account for it? A hunger
that,
for?
That we just developed in town among students and townspeople and a few faculty members, a real audience for poetry. There was one man in the engineering school. I didn't know he was in the engineering school, but there was one man a bit older than me who always sat in the back of the auditorium every Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock. And after I quit doing it, the next year, that fall, I was walking up South U, and I bumped into this man. And he stopped and said, "Where are the poetry readings?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I quit doing it." And he said, "You shouldn't have quit doing it. That's been my entertainment. That's been my cultural life for 10 years. a man named Arch Naylor, who eventually was chairman of SACUA, was an engineering professor, a wonderful man. And he just discovered that poetry was sort of nice, and he did it every Tuesday afternoon.
I want to show you a photograph.
Oh, my God.
This is
that's the pig.
Can you talk about this event and what it led to?
Oh, my. My house was in the middle. Don's house was on my right. And Peter and Joan Blows and their two kids, Stephen and Sarah, lived on the left. And Stephen was a student of mine. Don and Jane and I saw them a lot, that bunch, and occasionally for beers or something. I saw a lot of them, and somehow they decided, maybe it was because we had big dinners a lot, I don't know, but they decided they were going to, he and Rick Burns were going to roast a pig. So they went to the market in Detroit and bought a pig. It was too big to fit in their oven, in their flat. So they had to cook it in the Blosses' house next door. And I was sitting there one afternoon on the little porch upstairs, and I looked out, and here are these two guys walking down the street carrying a pig on something like a stretcher on poles. And that night, they told us, they sent invitations in formal dress. So Don wore a tuxedo and Jane rented a tuxedo. And I didn't want to go rent a tuxedo, so I wore my old Marine uniform, which I used to wear demilitarized. I had other things in the collars instead of the little those things, and didn't wear my military hat, and I didn't wear the trousers with the red stripe down the side, but so I wore that, and the kids were all dressed formally, and we got there and had this wonderful dinner with a pig on the table and lots of wine. And I remember eventually Don sitting there, sort of leaning over the table, taking mouths full of pig and getting closer and closer to the pig. And then he wrote this wonderful, wonderful poem called Eating the Pig.
Tell me how you taught Ulysses.
Well, the first thing I always did teaching Ulysses was to make them read it aloud together with me. And we would we'd start at 8 o'clock in the morning in my house, and taking turns, we'd read all night long, all day long, then all night long. And we'd finish by sometime around 6 or 7, maybe 8 the next morning. But we were not much behind the time of the novel. And I would feed them all night, and we'd drink beer and cider. And then we'd start talking about it. But it was...
Did it help?
Oh, immensely. We were all getting to hear the novel. Yeah. And the kids would work hard at reading well. So it was a good experience for everybody. And then we just start talking our way through it.
Why Dickens?
When I was a kid, my grandparents had a complete set of Dickens that my grandfather had bought for my mother. My grandfather left school when he was 13 years old, went to work, son of Italian immigrants. My grandmother, daughter of Irish immigrants, this is on my mother's side, left school at 15. But Granddad got a set of Dickens for my mother. He was a very bright man who was the chairman of the Board of Regents for the State College then, now university, in our hometown. But when I inherited that set of Dickens, the pages weren't cut. Nobody had ever opened any of them. Didn't read Dickens in high school. Saw the old Alistair Sim movie of Christmas Carol. Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite one.
Yeah, that's so good. And then when I was in graduate school, finally, as an undergraduate, nobody mentioned Dickens in any of my classes. And in graduate school, I was doing a Victorian novel class the first term. And I read Our Mutual Friend, the next to the last novel. Big 900-page thing, like most of them. I was just blown off my feet. It was so wonderful. And that summer, I read all of Dickens, straight through.
Wow, that's a lot of pages.
15 novels. But it was so good. I'd read most of the day and go out for beers at night and come home and read some more. And then I went off to Dublin for a year to study. And I didn't do any Dickens at all while I was there. Somehow I decided I wanted to go back and do my dissertation on Thomas Hardy. And when I came back, I continued doing Hardy and wrote my dissertation. But I was a teaching fellow that year. And I had one sophomore literature class, and I taught Great Expectations in it. And then my next year, while I was writing my dissertation, I was an instructor, and I had three classes, and one of them each term was a literature class, so I got to teach a Dickens column class. And then I came here the next year, and one day the old chairman, Warner Rice, called me in and said, "Mr. Hornbeck, why aren't you teaching Dickens?"
Good question.
And I said, "Well, we don't have a Dickens class. We had a Chaucer class and a Milton Shakespeare class and a Milton class, but no other single author classes." So I said, "Well, there's not a class." And he said, "Well, we have Victorian literature. That could be Dickens if you made it such." So I taught a Dickens course.
What year was this?
Oh, must have been 68 or 69, yeah. And after that, I always had a Dickens class.
Did you start the public readings of A Christmas Carol around then, or was that later?
Started that in 74, I think. I had three doctoral students all doing Dickens, and one of them would be my teaching assistant at a time. They sort of came in order, three of them. And Nancy Metz, who's a professor now in Virginia, was the first one. And she suggested to me that I should read Christmas Carol. So I tried it, and I didn't do it very well, but decided it was fun. And so I practiced, and I got myself a black coat with tails and a fancy tux shirt, and I made myself a little velvet tie and learned how to make myself a beard and started practicing the carol. And I've done it 440-something times now.
That's amazing. I'm happy to say I heard at least a couple of them while you were here.
Yeah. One night in the art museum, the crowd was terribly enthusiastic, and they kept applauding and applauding and applauding after it was over with. And usually at the end of a reading, he would tell the audience that if they enjoyed the reading, they should contribute to Oxfam, and that there would be people with baskets as they left, and I would ask them to donate money to the famine relief group from London called Oxfam. And that night they were so incredibly enthusiastic. When finally I got them quiet, I said, "If you enjoyed this that much, then as you leave tonight, you must give all the money in your purses and wallets to Oxfam." And we got a huge amount of money. And on Tuesday in the mail, I got a letter. It said, "You're right, but we didn't have enough money in our wallet and purse for what we should contribute." It's a couple I'd never known, never met. And they sent me sent Oxfam a check for $250.
So theater and public readings, this was a big part of how you taught and what you felt was important.
Yeah, and I had a theater group for a long time. Students and faculty played.
What would you do?
Our first play was McBird, the satiric play against Lyndon Johnson, which Don directed, and I got to play McBird. He wore one red glove to signify that he was a murderer. And he wore a Superman costume. And then the next term, I put on an adaptation I'd made of Byron's poem Manfred. And we did it in the foyer of Angel Hall with Don as Manfred. And then we did Fielding's Tom Thumb in the foyer. And by then we had become the Lord Chamberlain's players.
Sure.
And I had a sort of group of people who wanted to play. And we'd frequently have one or two faculty members. Mostly it was students. And we did a play once or twice a year until, I guess, until about the late 80s, and that just sort of wore out.
What do you love about Dickens' writing and what he does?
It's the most engrossing, easy to enter writing I know, with a couple of exceptions. I mean, there are a couple of the novels in which he makes it very hard for you to get in, but once you make the effort and get in, it's just such a marvelous thing. I admire his social values very much. The characters are so wonderfully, complexly made, and some of them are so wonderfully lovable. Miss Betsy Trotwood and David Copperfield is one of my favorite people in the world for the things she says to David. Never be mean, never be false, never be cruel. Oh, his politics agree with me. I admire him as he brings himself up close to being violent, but won't do it. There's lots of times when he wants to blow things up. And he has that wonderful character in Bleak House, Mr. Boythorn, who's always wanting to blow everything up, but is a very gentle man. He always has a bird on his shoulder. I find it just immensely exhilarating to read Dickens. And he reads so well aloud.
So I only have a couple more questions. This came from Carol. She told me to ask you about the trash collector you invited to have a beer with you in the backyard.
When I was moving in there, I was remodeling lots of things and knocking out walls and such. And one week I had just a ton of stuff, big stuff, sitting in my front yard in bags and trash cans and such. And the garbage truck came and stopped and blew the horn. I looked out the window. I was upstairs working. And this man went, so I went downstairs. And he said, I don't have to take that. I said, well, how am I going to get rid of it? And he said, you hire somebody to come take it away. And I said, I don't think I have money enough to do that. And he said, well, I don't have to take it. And I said, can I put it on your truck? And he said, yeah, if you want to do that, you can. So I carted all this stuff out and loaded it onto his truck, and he drove off. And the next week, pulled up, blew the horn. I looked out, and so I went down and I picked up my trash cans and put them on the truck, and he thanked me and drove off. And over the course of the summer, that this was a regular little social occasion. And he took everybody else's trash, but when he got to my house, he stopped and I went out. And one day I went down and I was putting my trash on his truck, and he said, you know, Bert, we've been doing this for several months now, and you have never invited me to have a beer. And I said, well, come have a beer. And so he called down the street to this kid who was his number two man, making sure that the trash was out to the curb. Come on up here. So we went, and I'd come out the back door, so we went down the driveway, around to the back door, and I started in, and he just stood there. And I said, come on in. And he said, no, I smell a garbage. I said, just bring the beer out here. So I brought three beers out, and there was a picnic table in the backyard. And so we sat down and drank a beer together and talked about all sorts of things.
While the garbage truck was still out there?
Hmm?
The garbage truck was just
parked
out back
in front.
Out the street?
Yeah. Yeah. And finally they went on back. And after that, usually he'd stop by and we'd chat for a while. Sometimes we'd go have a beer if he had time. It was a very nice relationship.
That's great.
Taught me a lot. One day he said, who does the most important work in town? What would happen to Ann Arbor if people like you quit? And I said, oh, nothing much. He said, what would happen if we quit? He said, who gets paid more, you or me? I said, me. Who should get paid more, you or me? You. He said, at least you're thinking right, Bert.
Yeah.
And he drove off.
That's great. Okay, just the last question. I wasn't going to get political, but I do want to know what in your experience, in your career, and in your reading can give us some encouragement for what we're about to embark upon in this country.
I think one thing to do would be to read Dickens's Bleak House. That might give us some useful inspiration. That's the novel in which, over and over again, he wants to blow this world up. He's so angry. And every now and then, the rhetoric gets all the way up to the edge of wanting to blow it up, but he comes back down. And then he starts creating for himself, all the little alternatives to what this big world is offering. I mean, he gets wound up and says, my lords and gentlemen and honorable boards, when you, in the course of your dust shoveling and cinder raking, and he goes on telling them that one of these days, everybody is going to say, off with your coats and get to work. Do something. He keeps threatening over and over to blow things up. And he's got a character in it who wants to blow things up. He's got another character who's a bad guy who spontaneously combusts. Mr. Crook. He's also got the crossing sweeper who does the important work for pennies, who when he's dying is just such a loving little creature and wants to be remembered as somebody who did his work. And in the end, he's got some good people who are doing work in the world. And Esther Summerson is the bright light of the novel. I think it's a good novel to read in times like these.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be back in Ann Arbor. And last night I got to meet old friends at Carol and Andy's that I haven't seen in a long time, all my old neighborhood. And it's wonderful to have the occasion you've given me to think about all the rich, wonderful years I had here.
I'm glad. It was really wonderful to talk to you, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you.